Okay, well, thanks for having me here. I'd like to discuss how we can formulate general relativity on the lattice consistently, and I'm going to tell you what I mean by consistently in a second. So I'll start with a little introduction to why this is of interest. Then we'll discover that in order to do this, we need to rethink a little bit how to do Hamiltonian dynamics. This is going to be kind of the lowest intellectual point of the talk. I'm going to start talking about the particle and a potential in one dimension, classically. But hopefully we'll recover back to quantum gravity by the end of the talk. And so this is work we did with Rodolfo Gambini from Montevideo. So everyone knows that lattice techniques have been successful for dealing with non-perperturbatively with Yang-Mills theory. And ever since this was first discussed, people have thought, well, why don't we do this for gravity? This is attractive in various ways, because you can put the theory in a computer, solve it. You might provide points of contact with condensed matter physics, just like it happened for Yang-Mills theory. But there is a major difference between gravity and Yang-Mills theory, and it's the fact that the introduction of a lattice in Yang-Mills theory is a Gaussian invariant regularization of the theory, whereas in general relativity, if you introduce a lattice to discretize the theory, you break the gauge symmetry of the theory, which is the invariance under diffeomorphisms of the theory. Moreover, since, at least for general relativity, and when I talk about quantum gravity here, I'm one of these people who still tries to make sense of general relativity quantum mechanically. At least in the case of general relativity, there's no at hand any obvious notion of renormalizability of the theory. And renormalizability plays a very important role when people formulate Yang-Mills theory on the lattice at the time of taking the continuum limit of the theory. So it is expected that lattice versions of gravity, the continuum limit is going to be non-trivial or quite different from the way it works in Yang-Mills theory. Worse, as we're going to see in a second, the discrete theories one gets when one formulates general relativity on the lattice are inconsistent theories. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to take a look at these theories, take them seriously, and see what we can do with them. Namely, first of all, I'd like to make them consistent, and then discuss how would one go about quantizing these theories. What we're going to see is that actually having a discrete theory that is consistent on the lattice, in fact, makes the theory conceptually cleaner to quantize. Many of the kind of long-standing conceptual problems of quantum gravity suddenly are gone when one does this. And it also might suggest some non-standard alternatives on how one might define the continuum limit in spite of the fact that the theory is not renormalizable. So let me address first of all this issue of the consistency. What do I mean by inconsistency? So let me go and take a look at situations in which people have taken Einstein equations and have discretized them. So perhaps the most traditional place where people discretize general relativity is when they try to integrate the Einstein equations numerically. Of course, computers only really know how to do integer algebra. So when you say that you solve a differential equation in a computer, what you normally are doing is you're replacing the differential equation by some finite approximation to it. So people who try to, for instance, collide two black holes, numerical relativity, actually take the Einstein equations, discretize them, and solve the discrete equations in the computer. This has been around forever. But people have also looked at discretizations of general relativity in the quantum context. For instance, in canonical quantum gravity, people want to treat the Hamiltonian constraint of the theory. They need to regularize the operator, and one way in which people have done it is by putting the theory on the lattice. Also, people have attempted to discretize general relativity to make sense of the path integral. Path integral for gravity, of course, is infinite dimensional. We don't know how to compute infinite dimensional integrals, so one way of making it finite is by discretizing the theory. For instance, people who do spin foams do this. In all these three cases, the theories you get are inconsistent. I'd like to discuss that in some detail. I'm going to show that these people up here have an argument that kind of lets them off the hook. That is, they can do with an inconsistent theory. These other people, however, have some explanation to give you if they're going to quantize a theory that doesn't exist classically. So let's take a look at numerical relativity first. So this is not quantum theory. This is just classical general relativity done in a computer. So 95% of people who do numerical relativity, what they do is the usual 3 plus 1 decomposition of the Einstein equations. So you have that the Einstein equations break into two different sets. One set of equations are constraints that hold at every instant of time. The other set of equations are evolution equations that tell you how to evolve the variables forward in time. It is well known that in the continuum, as for usual general relativity in the continuum, if you start with a solution of the constraints initially and you evolve it with the evolution equations, the evolved variables satisfy the constraints in the future automatically. It is also well known that this is not true for the discrete theory. That is, if you start with a solution of the discrete constraint equations and evolve it using the discrete evolution equations, the resulting variables do not satisfy the discrete constraints. Therefore, you essentially cannot solve simultaneously the 10 Einstein equations when they're discretized. So what do people do? Well, most people these days that try to do, for instance, the binary black hole problem, do what is called free evolution. They start with a solution of the constraints and they evolve in time, and that's it. They don't check the constraints anymore. They might check the constraints, but generically they're not going to be satisfied. So they are solving, therefore, 6 of the 10 Einstein equations. Other group of people, for instance, the people that do quasi-stationary approximation for binary black holes, solve 5 of the 10 Einstein equations. The people who solve 6 criticize the ones that solve 5 because they're missing one equation, of course. So why don't you hear about this? I mean, when you hear a talk about the binary black hole problem, people don't come and tell you, oh, I'm just solving some of the Einstein equations. Okay, so what's going on? Well, of course, this is not the usual point of view. Most people who do numerical relativity really couldn't care less about the discrete theory. That is, what they say is, look, the discrete theory is just an accident that happened to me because the computer doesn't know better. But this is just an approximation for the continuum theory. I am tolerating errors in my discrete theory from the very beginning. When I look at an evolution equation in the discrete theory, the solution of that evolution equation is not the same as the evolution equation in the continuum theory. So I'm tolerating an error there. Therefore, if that error I tolerate is of the same order of the inconsistency of the equations, I should be okay. This argument was first, I think, made coherently in this way by Matt Chopsick in 1991. Until then, there are all sorts of statements in the literature, at least by some people, that are confusing. What Matt proved is a numerical analysis theorem that says if you satisfy your evolution equation to a certain order of accuracy, for instance, order delta squared, where delta is your lattice spacing, then the constraints are also preserved to order delta squared. They're not zero, but they're preserved to a certain order of accuracy as your evolution equations. And therefore, from this point of view, that's why these people are off the hook. They say, look, yes, my theory is inconsistent, but the inconsistency is the same order of the errors that I tolerate. What happens with people who want to quantize? No. So let me make the statement once more. The statement of Chopsick is a theorem, so it's very precise, and therefore it's limited as well its applicability. What he shows is that if your errors scale as a certain order with the discretization size, the constraints are preserved also as the same function of the discretization size, meaning if I take the discretization size to zero, the inconsistency goes to zero. Now, this inconsistency could grow as much as you want as a function of time and still go to zero when you take the parameter to zero. And in fact, that happens in practice. So they're not entirely off the hook from a practical point of view. And people are thinking about this, that is, how can we avoid, with the numerical schemes that we have, getting off the constraint surface uncontrollably, in spite of the fact that I'm still order delta square accurate. So what happens with people who want to do quantum gravity and discretize things? Let me take a look at the case of canonical quantum gravity. So I'd like to refer to Feynman's quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint. Some people in the audience have heard, at least, that in 1997, using these Ashtikar variables and loop quantization, Thomas Feynman, who at the time was a postdoc at Harvard and is now at the Albert Einstein Institute, presented a quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint of general relativity, that is, a finite, anomaly-free, well-defined, non-divergent version of the quantum Einstein equations. That is, he provided us, for the first time, with a quantum theory of gravity that is well-defined. Is it correct or is it not correct? There is still argument about that, but the theory is well-defined. So let me show you what he does. This is a little bit unfair to Thomas. His papers occupy 244 pages in Classical and Quantum Gravity. But what I want to refer to happens in one page, so I have the page here. And I know some of you don't follow the details of this, so if you don't worry, because the idea I want to address doesn't really depend on the details. So he starts with a classical expression, this Hamiltonian constraint of general relativity, written in terms of these variables that Ashtigar introduced. So this is the curvature, this is the connection, this is the volume of the spatial slice, this is the Poisson bracket here. And let's read what he does. He says, well, we now triangulate sigma, which is the spatial manifold, into elementary tetrahedra, and then basically what he does is he writes a discretized approximation of this expression. So for instance, where it says the curvature, he considers the holonomy along a little loop. Where it says the connection, he considers the holonomy along a little link. So he's writing effectively a discrete approximation of this expression here. Well, what he then notices, and this is kind of a non-trivial part, is that all these operators that he has, these holonomies and the volume operator, in this loop representation of quantum gravity are all naturally well-defined operators. So the quantization of gravity from there on consists in just putting hats on top of these things. And it's not a joke, because the hat is a well-defined mathematical operator, because these operators are well-defined. Anyway, that's not the point I want to emphasize. The point I want to emphasize is that as you realize, what he's doing is he's not quantizing general relativity, he's quantizing a discrete version of the theory. So what is going on here is the following. He's saying, I'm starting with a continuum classical theory in terms of the Ashtigar variables, the triad and the connections. He writes a discrete classical theory in terms of the holonomies and volumes and the triangulation, and he quantizes the resulting theory. So what I'd like to ask today is, what do we know about this classical theory that is getting quantized? Well, we know little, actually, as it's normally the case when one discretizes theories. In particular, this theory is inconsistent in the sense we discussed before. That classical expression that he had here, this classical expression up here, being the Hamiltonian constraint of general relativity in the continuum, is a constraint, and therefore, for instance, satisfies a Poisson algebra of constraints, meaning that if I iterate the constraint several times, I don't get a new set of constraints, I just get back the old constraints. That's not the case for this expression here. To me, that's problematic, because it means that if you, for instance, take Poisson brackets of this with itself, you get more constraints, and therefore, what do? It's you impose them, you don't impose them, etc. So that's what I'd like to understand today. Let me make a caveat, however, because this sounds like I'm attacking Feynman's quantization, and I'm not. Feynman is kind of a clever guy, and he doesn't quite do what I said here, and that's why it takes 244 pages to tell the story. What Feynman does is he quantizes this discrete classical theory that I discussed there, but at the same time he takes a non-trivial limit. That is, he takes a look at the space of solutions of the diffeomorphism constraint. By doing that, he can show that the resulting quantum theory that he has here actually is consistent. The algebra constraint that he has within this context is the correct one. So it's not inconceivable that starting from a theory that doesn't make sense classically, and it's kind of difficult to see how you would quantize, you kind of take the step, include this limit, and you land on the correct quantum theory at the end. It is plausible that it could happen. I, however, would like to understand better the starting point, because it is clear that something very non-trivial is going on here. If you start with something that is classically inconsistent, and you land on something that is quantum consistent at the quantum level. Now you might ask, well, but so why don't people discretize these theories in a way that they are consistent? I mean, can't they find a discretization that is consistent? Well, let me show you how. It turns out to be remarkably difficult to actually find discretizations just by accident that are consistent, but one can construct them. So here's, this is the low point intellectually of the talk. I'd like to take a look at classical mechanics. In fact, a particle in a potential in one dimension. So I'll let just, this is just a mechanical system, it's not a field theory, so the only thing I can discretize here is time. So I'd like to take a look at the system and discretize time and see what it is. So here's the action. So instead of having an integral over time, I have a sum over all time intervals, delta t. Where it used to say pq dot, I write p and an discrete approximation to q dot, and this is the Hamiltonian. This is not the free particle, it's the particle in a potential. So I'd like to take this theory seriously. If I take that action and vary it, what you get is quite sensible. You get essentially a discrete approximation to Hamilton's equations. Q dot is P, P dot is the gradient to the potential. So this is good. The theory makes sense. It's a good approximation to classical mechanics. And of course, there is no consistency problem in this theory because there are no constraints. However, this theory already has the germ of the inconsistency in it. Because what one can immediately check that conserved quantities that depend both on Q and P, like the energy, for instance, in certain cases, will fail to be conserved by the evolution equations. This is well known in astronomy. For instance, astronomers have known for ages that if you want to follow a planetary orbit and you just discretize Newton's law, after a while, after a couple of orbits, the angular momentum and the energy of the system have drifted. So astronomers for ages have been using special integration schemes that do not worry so much about the accuracy of x of t, but that worry about the accuracy of the conservation of the energy and the angular momentum. Of course, I could turn this into an inconsistent problem if you want to. I could decide to study the particle in a potential with energy equal to 32 ergs. Then it would be inconsistent because that constraint would be violated. So the germ of the problem is already there in a simple system as this. So how do you fix this? Well, actually, this solution to this problem was first proposed, that I know of, by T.D. Lee. And it's a very nice proposal from the point of view of relativists, because what actually T.D. Lee proposes is to parameterize a particle. So let me show you what he does. So he considers the following action, which is the same thing we had before, but it's pq dot minus h. And instead of putting delta t as I had there, he puts tn minus 1, tn plus 1 minus tn. This is delta t. So it's the same action we had before. But the new twist that T.D. Lee introduces into this is he's not going to consider this action only as a function of q and p, but he's going to consider it as a function of q, p, and time. So he takes as variables for the theory q, p, and time. Now, when you vary this action with respect to time, the only place that time appears is here. So if I vary, for instance, with respect to tn, I get h evaluated at the position n, and I'll also get a contribution when this term was at n minus 1. So I get h at n minus 1. So the equation I get is this one, which implies that the constraint is automatically conserved. There's a price to pay for this, because your dynamical variables are q, p, and t. You now have an equation for t, meaning the time intervals are not free anymore. They're determined by the theory. So T.D. Lee is able to enforce the constraint at the price of not controlling the time intervals anymore. The time intervals are determined by the theory. So how do you translate this into GR? Well, let me re-examine this a little bit, just writing it as a constraint system. So I'd like to write the action as pq dot, and just put a Lagrange multiplier times Hamiltonian minus a constant. So the energy is 32, this would be 32. And what I'd like to do is take this action and consider it as a function of p, q, and the Lagrange multiplier now. So if I do a variation of this action with respect to the Lagrange multiplier, I immediately get that the constraint is satisfied. But I'll now get three equations, one for p, one for q, and one for lambda. So the Lagrange multipliers are determined by this construction. This is not what usually happens in mechanics. In mechanics, the Lagrange multipliers are free. In discrete theories, to enforce the constraints, the Lagrange multipliers get determined. That's the message that comes out from this construction of T.D. Lee. Viewing the problem in this way immediately tells you what you need to do in the case of general relativity. So suppose we want to make a consistent discretization of the Einstein equations. How would the proposal read? Well, start with a metric and an extrinsic, for instance, if you're using the metric variables, start with a metric and an extrinsic curvature that satisfy the discrete Hamiltonian constraint initially. Okay? Now take an evolution step with your discrete evolution equations, but do not fix the laps and the shift, just keep them free. Okay? So you evolve, and you have a metric and an extrinsic curvature that is a function of these free lapses and shifts that you have. Now demand that the Hamiltonian momentum constraint be satisfied by fixing the laps and the shift. You have four quantities to determine, the three components of the shift vector and the laps, and you have four equations to determine them, the four constraints. These are algebraic equations, nonlinear, but algebraic equations, so generically you have a solution. So the system is made consistent by determining the Lagrange multipliers, just like before.
What happens in the continuum limit?
In the continuum limit, the equations that determine the Lagrange multipliers become singular, that is, the coefficients go to zero, and they're not determined. So this construction only makes sense for the discrete theory. And the continuum limit is not going to arise by taking the limit in this way.
But isn't that going to make numerical difficulties?
Not necessarily. I'm going to show you examples. So it's going to make difficulties if you take the continuum limit in that way.
So presumably the time step which comes out of this is related to the spatial sort of discretization?
They're all mixed, yeah. Of course, there are lots of problems that can arise here. I mean, the equations that determine this are algebraic equations, but they're nonlinear and coupled. Therefore, for instance, there's no guarantee that the solutions are going to be real. There's no solution that n is going to be positive. Okay, so in principle, there are lots of potential problems here, and this is not going to work in general. If it works for sufficient examples, then it's an interesting construction. So the burden is on me to come to you in some time and tell you, well, I worked out all these examples. Today I'm going to show a few, but certainly not enough to convince you that this is the way to go. Well, but if we need to do a quantum theory out of this, we need a little bit more than just consistent discretization, because I need to tell you how you handle these systems. I need to build a Hamiltonian mechanics for it. So what I'd like to do now is discuss how do you treat canonically these discrete theories. So you start with a discrete action. So your action now, instead of having an integral, you have the sum. I absorb the delta t into L. Otherwise, you had delta t there. And your Lagrangian is not a function of q and q dot anymore, because there's no q dot anymore. Q dot got replaced by qn plus 1 minus qn. So therefore, your Lagrangian is a function of qi and qi plus 1. Already makes things a little bit strange, because if I work out the Lagrange equations, they, of course, don't look at all like the traditional Lagrange equations, because q dot is not there anymore. So these are the Lagrange equations that follow from here. So fine. But then I would like to introduce Hamiltonian mechanics for this. So normally I would like to perform a Legendre transform. Well, but I don't have a q dot anymore, so that's already confusing. But furthermore, I'd like to convince you that a Hamiltonian mechanics is not what you really want here. What is the Hamiltonian in classical mechanics? The Hamiltonian is the infinitesimal generator of time evolutions. Now, in a theory where time is discrete, of course, there is no sense to defining an infinitesimal generator of time evolutions. This is a fundamental problem that I think people have gotten wrong over the years. For instance, lots of people have tried to take the constraints of generativity and discretize them on a lattice. Some of the constraints of generativity are associated with the diffeomorphisms on the manifold, the infinitesimal generator of diffeomorphisms. On a lattice where everything is finite, you clearly are not going to ever have an infinitesimal generator. You need something else. In this simpler context of just mechanics, what I'd like to argue you need is not a Hamiltonian, but what you need is the closest thing you can have, a finite generator of time evolution. Now, in classical mechanics, we know how to generate a finite time evolution through a canonical transformation. So what's going to play the central role in the formulation of mechanics of discrete theories is not a Hamiltonian, but the generator of a canonical transformation that takes you from Tn to Tn plus 1. So you can write, actually, a generating function f for a canonical transformation that actually implements time evolution. Generating function is just simply given by minus the Lagrangian. So this is the canonical transformation is minus the Lagrangian. I mean, remember, canonical transformations of type 1, they're a function of little q and big q, your old and new q's. So you're seeing here as your old q is qn, your new q is qn plus 1. And as usual, p is defined through the canonical transformation in this way. I apologize for these equations. They look wrong because this one looks like inconsistent with this one. But where it says f, it should be really f of qn here, and here is f of qn plus 1. So these are not the same equation. This canonical transformation has a dual role. It generates the two evolution equations. So you can view it, one of these equations as the evolution equation for q, and the other one as the evolution equation for p. But in addition to that, it introduces the notion of p that I didn't know how to introduce because I didn't have a q dot. So you can check, for instance, that if you assume that qn and pn have traditional Poisson brackets at instant n, this canonical transformation guarantees that qn plus 1 and pn plus 1 actually have the same Poisson bracket structure. So the Poisson bracket structure introduced in this way is automatically preserved by the canonical transformation. So we're almost there now, because I know how to do a mechanical system. And remember, if I want to do a lattice field theory, the lattice field theory is a mechanical system. I'm really close to being able to do general relativity here, in spite of the fact that this just looked like textbook classical mechanics. There's one more ingredient I need, which is that general relativity has constraints. So I need to show you how to do this. It's the same thing, basically. just when I have constraints. So here I'm going to assume I have a Lagrangian just as before. So PQ dot minus a Hamiltonian perhaps. Epsilon is delta t in this slide for some reason. I'm going to assume there's a bunch of constraints here. Of course, there's a little bit of an abuse of annotation. If I want a bunch of constraints, really I should have many q's and many p's. So you should think that the q's and the p's have a little arrow on top or something to indicate there's more than one per each slice of time. But you can actually show that the same construction as before, namely taking minus the Lagrangian as your generator of a canonical transformation, yields a canonical transformation like this. And so this doesn't look too familiar looking, written this way. But if you rewrite these equations as evolution equations, so I told you one of the two could be viewed as the evolution equation for P, and one as the evolution equation for Q, you get this. Now this is more familiar looking. So this is just usual Hamilton's equations for a system with constraints. The constraints have to be zero, of course. So if you squint your eyes and forget about the ends and all the stuff, these look like the equations you normally see in a textbook for the Hamiltonian mechanics, or the evolution equations for a system with constraints. But as we argued earlier in the talk, there is a fundamental difference here with the continuum case. Namely, these equations here do not imply that this equation is satisfied forever. This equation only holds at one instant, and it's not going to hold into the future, unless you choose your Lagrange multipliers. So for instance, if I take these evolution equations and rewrite this equation at the next instant of time, I'm going to get a bunch of equations equal to zero that will be zero provided the Lagrange multipliers have certain particular values. So Lagrange multipliers are determined as a functions of Q and P. And perhaps your system could be indeterminate and you might have some free parameters, meaning there are certain gauge symmetries that haven't been broken. So given this, you can now proceed to try to do field theories with this. I would love to show you a couple of examples that we worked out, but I don't have time for these two examples because I want to get to an example of interest in gravity. But I would like to show these examples because they show a couple of lessons. So we worked out Yang-Mills theory on the lattice this way. So we did a Hamiltonian treatment on the lattice of Yang-Mills theory. Now, you probably all have heard in the past the words Hamiltonian and Yang-Mills theory on the lattice. So what's new here? Well, if you go and see what people used to do, who did Hamiltonian and Yang-Mills theory on the lattice, is they never really formulated the theory as a discrete mechanical theory. What they did is they wrote the action of the theory, in the Euclidean case, by the way, and applied what is called the transformatrix method. Namely, you look at this action, and you essentially read off from it a Hamiltonian. That, by the way, requires a Euclidean rotation, which, of course, in the case of gravity, we don't have. And it's a construction that basically people have only made work in Yang-Mills theory and not in other theories. What we have shown here, and if you want after the talk, I have the slides with me, I can show them to you, but it just takes a little bit of time, is that we have actually worked from first principles the discrete mechanics of Yang-Mills theory in the lattice. You start from the Wilson action without assuming a Euclidean rotation. You introduce this canonical transformation. You work out the equations of motion, the gazillion of constraints. You have to treat them with a Dirac procedure. And at the end of the day, a couple of things happen. First of all, you get the usual correct Hamiltonian, E squared plus B squared. You get Gauss's law, which at the beginning was nowhere to be seen. And the Poisson bracket that you get for the holonomy and the electric field is the Rentel-Smalling Poisson bracket, which it's kind of surprising that it has this name, because you might think, well, didn't people in Yang-Mills theory notice this thing before? No, because they never cared about doing things this way. So when they had the transformatrix method, they immediately got the Hamiltonian and they were done. Getting the correct Poisson bracket, to my knowledge, was first discovered by these people by trial and error. You don't need to do it that way. You can just get it out of treating the theory in the Dirac procedure correctly. And by the way, all works in the Lorentzian signature case, that is, you don't need to do your Euclidean rotation for this. So this is, if you want, it's just a confirmation that the technique works, but it's nothing new. What is new is we were able to treat BF theory with this technique. The BF theory is a topological theory. And this one people didn't know how to do on the lattice a la Yang-Mills because the transformatrix method didn't work, because the theory, first of all, is not easy to Euclidean rotate, and it's a theory with constraints and so on that have to do with space-time symmetries. So using the technique we just discussed, BF theory can be implemented on the lattice. The details are here. Let me, however, work or show you how the case of gravity would be done with this, and then work out an example well, in the case of gravity, that illustrates several of the questions that have arisen up to now, like how does the continuum limit work in this and so on. So how do you handle gravity in this case? Well, you need to start with an action for gravity. And if you're going to put gravity in a lattice, the use of these Ashtagar variables is kind of a natural thing to do. You don't have to do it that way, but it's kind of the actions that discretize most naturally. So the action for general relativity can be written this way in terms of these new variables. This particular version of the action is present, for instance, in the Capovilla-Dahl, Jacobson, Mason paper. It is just the usual Ashtagar action, except that instead of having the Gauss law separate out there and a term E a dot here, they're both combined into this term, which is nicer because it's automatically gauge invariant. But that's only there is to it. Here you can recognize the Hamiltonian constraint E times E times F times the lapse. This is a diffeomorphism constraint E times F times the shift. I mean, if you squint your eyes and don't know I'm talking about gravity, you might think I'm doing some weird Yang-Mills theory, basically with an electric field and a connection. So it's not surprising that this action you can just discretize on the lattice, basically. What you do is you replace all the Fs by holonomies. These Hs are horizontal holonomies. Vs are holonomies in space-time direction. The Es, as in the lattice usual case, live at the vertices. And that's all there is to it, basically. You discretize this action. You define a canonical transformation with generating function minus this Lagrangian. And you work out the evolution equations. When you do that, there's a ton of constraints. So many of the evolution equations are zero. So for instance, the canonical momenta associated with a holonomy is this expression here. All the other canonical momenta for all the other variables, like these Lagrangian multipliers that appear here and so on, vanish. So you get a ton of constraints. So at the end of the day, the correct generating function for the theory is minus the Lagrangian plus a bunch of constraints. So I'm not giving you all the details of this because it's just impossible to follow in a short amount of time. But basically, you get minus the Lagrangian and then Lagrangian multipliers times bunches of constraints, basically all the canonical momenta that are zero. So if you examine carefully the evolution equations that are implied by this and start substituting them back in all these constraints that you get, you realize that this one determines one of the Lagrangian multipliers, this one there. You substitute in here, you get Gauss's law. You substitute them in here, you get that the holonomies live in the gauge group that you started with. And finally, these give the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints that are solved in terms of the lapse and the shift. Now, since the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraint are solved, there's no need to check an algebra for them because they're not there as constraints anymore. So classically, this theory is unconstrained. That's what I was referring earlier in the talk as to the fact that treating the theory consistently in the lattice does away with some of the difficult conceptual issues of general relativity. So one of the difficult conceptual issues of general relativity is what do you do with the algebra of constraints? Well, you do nothing here because the constraints are no more. They're being solved for the lapse and the shift.
But does the algebra of the constraints that are there?
There are no more constraints at the end of the day. That's the point.
What about all those pi's?
No. The pi's are all solved for all the Lagrangian multipliers.
Oh, I see.
So at the end of the day, your theory is constraint-free. Constraint-free theory, by the way, means that it's trivial to discuss observables in this theory because everything commutes with everything because there's no constraints to commute with, let's put it this way. So, now I'm not trying to tell you this computationally is easy. In particular, solving these particular equations for the lapse and the shift is complicated. You essentially get a coupled system of algebraic equations and the whole manifold gets coupled. So for instance, if you're working an example where things depend only, say, on one dimension in space, and you put, say, 100 points in your lattice, you get generically 400 by 400 equations here. So it's computationally intensive and difficult for a generic situation. As we argued before, these equations are not necessarily going to be well-behaved in the solutions for N and A they present. So I'm not trying to tell you that the problem of quantizing gravity has become suddenly easy computationally. But what I'm pointing out is that conceptually, suddenly, many of these difficulties that we had before are gone. So what people want at this point is for me to show this work in some particular context. So as I argued, computationally, this is intensive. So we're going to start with contexts that are reasonably easy. Yes?
I just want to make sure I understand this result. So
yeah.
I mean, it the old days, people said, well, you know, you have some description of gravity in terms of the metric, and it's the three metric and its time derivative or the connection triad. And you might imagine trying to solve the constraint for a subset of those variables, which are then sort of, quote, the true degrees of freedom and quantize that. But you're not doing that. You're not constraining. You have the full tetrad, the full connection, and you're solving the constraints for these auxiliary variables, the laps and the shift.
Right.
And then you view the sort of connection and the tetrad as unconstrained.
Right. Well, the resulting theory is unconstrained. And my burden is to show that the resulting theory has nothing to do with gravity. And the first time you hear this is very surprising, because you, well, come on, I mean, in general relativity, the laps and the shift are free. Now you're telling me that somehow someone comes and tells you what their value is. So how could these two theories that are so distinct have something in common? And I do not claim to have a complete understanding of this. What I can just show you is how it works in some examples. And there's some points that are enlightening. So let me show you one example, and we can continue talking.
There's a famous conjecture called there's no such thing as a free lunch. So is this a counterexample?
Did I show you lunch yet? How do you know it's free, therefore? No, my burden now is to show you lunch. That is, if I can show you, show me the lunch, basically. If I can present to you that this works in some context and show results, then it might be free, or depending how much it costs me to do it. So you cannot consider this the end of the story of quantizing gravity, I mean, clearly. Well, so let me show you how it works in some cases, and you can decide. So let me take a look at quantum cosmology, for instance. So it's kind of the simplest thing you can think about. So I'd like to take the simplest possible thing, but not too simple, because if I take just too simple, then no degrees of freedom and so on. So I'd like to take a cosmological model that has some level of degrees of freedom so I can do something with it, and it's not so complicated that I cannot work it out. Okay. So I'd like to take a look at the Friedmann model. I'll throw in a cosmological constant. I don't know why, but it's there. And what I want is to have a scalar field, at least, so this has at least one degree of freedom classically. I'll make it very massive, so it's even simpler to solve, but that's about it. So if you write in terms of these new variables, the Friedmann model, so there's only one metric component, therefore there's only one triad component of any notice. Everything's a function of time. This is a continuum theory at the moment. So you get the Lagrangian is EA dot. This is the only component of the connection that is left in a Friedmann model. This is pi phi dot. This is the kinetic, or the Lagrangian for the free scalar field. This is the Hamiltonian constraint, or whatever is left of it. So the term that was EEF before, because everything is homogeneous, the F doesn't have spatial derivatives, so it's just the A squared term. This is a cosmological constant term, so it's cosmological constant times the volume, so EEE is the volume. And this is the mass term of the scalar field, volume times the scalar field squared. And I drop the kinetic term of the scalar field. That's the very massive approximation. So of course one can solve this completely in the continuum. So this is the solution. It's actually de Sitter space, because the scalar field, very massive, has no dynamics, so it behaves as a constant. So this is the connection and the triad, exact solution for this problem. Just expand exponentially. Let's see if we can work this out in the discrete theory. So I'd like to take this Lagrangian and discretize it. So the same story as before. E a dot becomes E, an approximation to a dot. P phi dot becomes P, approximation to phi dot. This thing is an approximation to this, except that there's a typo here. I forgot the E there, but that's about it. Well, you can work out the canonical transformation and so on. You get a bunch of evolution equations. You get four evolution equations. The evolution equations are not terribly enlightening, so this data that appears there is there. The scalar field is constant. This is the very massive approximation that we had before. But if you stare at these equations and forget about the indices and all the details, you're kind of surprised, because the constraints are gone now. I solved them. Okay? I have four variables and four evolution equations. That's sort of funny, right? Because the system, therefore, has four phase space degrees of freedom. No constraints, four variables, phase space. The continuum theory, however, only had two phase space degrees of freedom. It had four variables, but it had one first class constraint. So this is kind of the funny thing we were talking a minute ago. How could these two theories have anything to do with each other? Well, so let's see what happens. The continuum theory has two observables, meaning quantities that commute with a Hamiltonian constraint, or have vanishing Poisson bracket with a Hamiltonian constraint. You can write them in many ways, but one of the simplest ones, of course, the scalar field. It's a constant of the motion. And it's also an observable, by the way, for the discrete theory. In the continuum theory, one has a second observable that can be written in this way. So you can check in the continuum theory that this quantity has vanishing Poisson bracket with a Hamiltonian constraint. Therefore, it's a constant of the motion. And of course, you can rewrite this in many different ways by substituting the Hamiltonian constraints. There are many weakly equivalent versions of the observables of the theory. Now, remarkably, in this discrete theory, this quantity here, but if you remember, this theta was equal to that. This quantity here, which is just a discretization of this quantity here, is a constant of the motion. Now, I could discretize this in many ways, and it's not going to be an exact constant of the motion of the discrete theory. And of course, if I take many weakly inequivalent versions of these and discretize them, they're not going to be preserved by the discrete theory. But somehow, the message coming out here is that in the discrete theory, there are constants of the motion that are associated with observables of the continuum theory. So somehow, this discrete theory has a remnant of the symmetry of the continuum theory. And this is the part I don't claim to understand very well myself. Namely, there seems to be something more in these discrete theories than meets the eye. Yes, they seem to have more degrees of freedom, but somehow, the fact that you had two constants of the motion in the continuum theory is still reflected in this discrete theory as well. So this is kind of suggesting that this discrepancy in the degrees of freedom is not necessarily fatal, because if you think of the continuum theory, the observables are associated with the true degrees of freedom in the theory. And here, what we're seeing is the number of constants of the motion that appears is the same as the number of observables that you had in the continuum theory. In fact, let me show you that the discrete theory actually approximates the continuum theory very well. So here are solutions of those discrete evolution equations that we had before. So this is the triad. This is the connection. And I'm superposing here the continuum solution and the discrete solution. You cannot see the difference. So I blow it up for you here. This is the neighborhood of that point there. So as you see, this is the usual De Sitter universe expanding from the point where there was a coordinate zero-volume singularity. In this case, it's not a true singularity, of course. It expands out. And this is the discrete recursion relation we had there, following the theory reasonably well. The discrete theory has the feature that the singularity, or in this case, the coordinate singularity at t equals 0, is avoided. The recursion relation just walks through the singularity and walks back like this. This is not surprising. If you have a theory with a singularity in time, and you discretize time, of course, generically, your singularity is not going to fall on the lattice. Unless you fine-tune your initial data, the recursion relation just walks through the singularity.
Is there some notion of how refined the discrete approximation is?
Yes. Let me get back to that in just a second, okay? Okay, I'll have something to say in a second. Let me, however, conclude a little bit of a discussion about the singularity. So in these kind of discrete theories, the singularity falls off the lattice generically, and therefore is not there. It's only there for a set of measure zero of initial data, which is, of course, not the case in general relativity. In general relativity, in this cosmology, whatever initial data I give, I hit the singularity at some point.
But you've somehow chosen some level of discreteness in the approximation.
Right. When you in these theories, when you choose your initial data, you choose the lapse automatically because you're solving for it. The lapse determines how fast you move. So in the initial data that you're choosing, you're choosing the level of approximation that you're picking in your theory.
It's the space discretization term.
Right. Right. Well, let me say more about the continuum limit. So can we see how this works a little bit? So one of the equations of the discrete theory, if you checked it in the previous slides, was this equation here. And this equation looks very much like the Hamiltonian constraint of the continuum theory. This is the F term. This was the terms of the volume, the cosmological constant, the scalar field. So this looks very much like the Hamiltonian constraint of the continuum theory, except for the detail that this quantity is evolved at instant n plus 1. So this quantity is approximately 0 in the continuum theory, but it's not equally 0 in the continuum theory, because this is the quantity that is 0 in the continuum theory. Conversely, if I take this quantity without the n plus 1 is not 0 in the discrete theory. But if the discrete theory and the continuum are approximating each other, both expressions should be approximately 0. So I'm going to use how different from 0 this is as an approximation of how well the discrete theory is approximating the continuum theory. So in the next diagram, I'd like to show an in a sort of dimensionless measure of this. So I'll just take this and divide it by that and compare it to 1 to see how well I'm approximating the continuum theory. So for this particular example, this is a plot. This quantity initially close to singularity is very different from 0, showing that the discrete and the continuum theory disagree with each other. And that's better be, because I told you one has a singularity, the other one doesn't. But as a function of time, they both agree. So, and this is true for generic initial data for this model. The continuum limit is achieved as an attractor into the future.
Well, what happens if you decrease your spatial step?
So if I decrease my spatial step, or I arrange the initial data for that to happen, all this kind of moves like that. Namely, I achieve the continuum limit before or after.
Does it become harder to solve the equations?
No. No, the discrete equations have no problem. But the message here, however, is that this model is such that asymptotically into the future, no matter what you do with the initial data, you achieve the continuum limit. Unfortunately, or I don't know if unfortunately, but it's a fact, this behavior is not generic. It's a feature of this model. So we have looked at other models and things work differently. So for instance, if I take a Freeman model with k equals 1, yes.
Let's see, could this be an application of what some people call cosmic baldness? I mean, the fact that if you're really doing some approximation to the sitter, all sorts of inhomogeneities and stuff get redshifted away, and basically just...
Well, that could be said, except for one example I'm going to show you in a second that doesn't work that way. So I don't think that's the root reason for that. So let me first discuss this one. So suppose I now take a Friedman model with k equals plus 1, so the model recollapses. So clearly, it cannot be in this case anymore that asymptotically into the future, I'm going to get the continuum limit. And in fact, that's what happens. The best you can do in such a model is to kind of, in the moment of maximum expansion, make it there that the theory kind of achieves the continuum limit. But as you go into the big crunch again, the discrete theory and the continuum theory disagree with each other badly, and the discrete theory walks through it and doesn't hit the singularity. So the best you can get is in some intermediate region, get a reasonable approximation to the continuum theory. And that is not generic for any initial data, because if I take initial data that the steps are so huge that I just walk through and hit the next singularity, I never reach that region. So there I need to tune my initial data a little bit to, in order to get, like in the moment of maximum expansion, a good approximation to the continuum theory. In a model where the scalar field is not infinitely massive, but the opposite end of things, with massless scalar field, the continuum limit doesn't work at all like in the previous two examples. Namely, it works more like the way we were discussing with Jim earlier. You control with initial data what the step size is, and that step size remains forever fixed. That is, there's no asymptotic sort of behavior. So this is kind of three different examples of how these, the same kind of technique for treating the discrete theory can produce different approximations to the continuum limit. So the continuum limit in this thing works in a very non-trivial way and is model dependent. It is there, but it's not just as simple as saying, oh, take something to zero. Let me say a few words about how does one quantize these models. So the immediate thing that comes to mind, of course, you have a canonical transformation. What you need to do if you want to quantize such a model, we may not have a Hamiltonian anymore, but we have the canonical transformation. What you would like to do is take that canonical transformation and implement it unitarily. So I take my operators as a given level and find a unitary operation that mimics, in, for instance, the Heisenberg picture, the discrete evolution equations I have on the continuum. That can be done. I mean, for these simple models, actually can be done explicitly. I'd like to argue how, so given that I have a theory has no constraints and evolution is given by this canonical transformation, I can quantize it by representing everything through a unitary evolution operator, and this can be worked out. There's no problem in the details, at least for simple models. But I'd like to argue this is not the way to go, because the resulting quantum theory you get is not terribly meaningful, because it will be expressed in terms of a time given by n. And n, of course, is not physically measurable. not a physically measurable quantity. I mean, in these models, I decided to call n equals 0 singularity, but it could have been n equals 1,000, right? There is no connection between n and a measurable quantity. Also, there's no notion of future and past, because depending on the initial data, the cosmology can decide to go to the future or into the past. And if I do a quantum state, I'll generically have superpositions of both behaviors, because since the initial data determines the lapse, I can have situations where the lapse points me backwards.
Let's see, little n is your step size.
Yeah, it's my step point.
Step point.
Yeah.
Now, the lapse, in the quantum theory, the lapse is still classical, still determined? Or is there some sort of...
Well, presumably I did away from the lapse altogether. I don't have it as a variable anymore. I could restore it if I want. But as you saw in the examples there, I had four variables. The lapse was gone. It had been solved for. So.
Right.
Just a dependent quantity, if you want.
Well, how many variables is the state dependent?
One question first.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you can reconstruct the lapse, if you know if you had it solved for,
right?
Then why can't you determine the proper time just from using the known lapse that you've already computed in n?
You could reconstruct the proper time if you want in that way, but it would be a quantum operator. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not normally quantum mechanics. Time has a more fundamental meaning, right? T is a classical variable, et cetera, et cetera. Here it's this n that means nothing.
I thought I was mistaken.
Okay. Also, many orbits, because there are different degrees, number of degrees of freedom in the two theories, many orbits of the discrete theory, as we argued before, correspond to the single orbit that you actually have in the continuum theory. This doesn't sound too natural as well. If you don't like these negative arguments, you think this is the way to quantize the system, let me point out, however, that you can explicitly show for these models that we have considered up to here, that the probability of hitting the singularity is identically zero, which is, of course, not surprising, because if in a classical theory, the singularity is only achieved for a set of measures, zero set of initial data, quantum mechanically is heavily suppressed probabilistically. The wave functions have correct. I mean, I was speaking a little bit in favor of this quantization. Sorry, this is a little bit. I first told you the negative aspects, I'm telling you a couple of positive aspects. Since we have no constraints, one can assign correct probabilistic interpretations to these wave functions, contrary to, for instance, some criticism that has been levied against the Hartle-Hawking interpretation of general relativity by some horrible people that. There is a way to do that, but the point here is you don't even need to worry about doing it that way. It comes out automatically. So, a more attractive possibility to quantize the system is to actually implement the relational definition of time that Page and Waters try to introduce in the case of general relativity. This is an old idea. I mean, the idea is that, I mean, it goes back to Leibniz and Mach and so on. It's the idea that time in mechanics really should arise as a relational notion between the variables of your system. There is no preferred time in general. If you have only one particle in the universe, you don't have time. If you have two, you might define a time by taking one to be the clock and the other one to be the observed system. Page and Waters tried to push this idea quantum mechanically. The quantum mechanics that they tried to construct was a quantum mechanics in which there was no parameter T that was treated as classical, but all variables of your system were treated quantum mechanically. And then what you did is you computed conditional probabilities for some of these variables as functions of the others. So you asked the question, if variable Q1 has value, say, something, what is the value of variable Q2? And you took that variable Q1 to be your clock. Of course, if your variable Q1 behaves classically and so on, this would agree with ordinary Schrodinger quantization, but there will be regimes in which this is not the case. So this sounded like an attractive idea to implement in the context of quantum cosmology and quantum gravity, where there is clearly not the clock universally defined. The idea that you would treat all degrees of freedom on an equal footing and then just compute conditional probabilities between them. So this is what I was saying before. A notion of time is introduced by choosing a given quantum variable now, call it T if you want, and you ask relational probabilities, relational probabilistic questions, what is the probability that variable X has a given value when this variable takes a different value? This, however, also was criticized by nice people like Kukash for various problems. The first problem you have when you apply this in the context of general relativity, of course, is what are these variables T and X that you're going to pick exactly? Because presumably in general relativity, you ought to pick variables that are observables of a theory. But the observables of the theory commute with the Hamiltonian constraint, and therefore are constants of the motion. Therefore, what's the sense of taking a constant of the motion of your clock? I mean, it's not going to change, right? So that's kind of the first objection that was levied against this. So Pigeon Water says, no, don't do that. Don't take X and T to be observables, but take them to be kinematical variables. For instance, component G23 of the metric and component G12 of the metric. Those evolve with time, and therefore you can try to play this game. Well, but the problems with that, because still at the end of the day, you would like to consider quantum states that are solutions of the constraints. If you take states that are solutions of the constraints and view them as within the context of all possible kinematical states, they are distributional in nature. Solutions of constraints are generically distributional. That means that they don't have a good probabilistic interpretation. And in particular, when they try to do a calculation with this, when they try to, for instance, compute a propagator, they get the wrong propagator for the particle. Basically, they get the particles don't, or a system treated in this way has no time propagation. The only propagator you get out of a construction like this, in the case of a constraint theory, is a propagator that's delta x minus x prime times delta t minus t prime.
I think there's a simpler objection over this, which is if you apply it to the parameterized Newtonian systems, one particle, as we were discussing before, you don't get non-relativistic quantum mechanics back.
That is true, and it's true for the reasons I have been discussing, namely. It's essentially the presence of the constraint which kills them. There's where I have enormous advantages over them, because I'm unconstrained. So all those objections that were levied against Page and Waters are gone. So I can play their game here without those conceptual difficulties. So I can compute a conditional probability. For instance, for the little model that we discussed before, I could take the connection A to be my clock and compute what is the conditional probability that the momentum of the scalar field, I cannot take the scalar field because it's a constant, but take the canonically conjugate momentum, which is evolves in time. What is the probability that that takes a value in the interval delta p when the connection took a value in the interval delta a? And the conditional probability is computed in this way. Interestingly enough, the n parameter that we had there plays a role in the calculation, but drops out in the limit. So the end result is completely relational, having to do with the variables of the problem, and doesn't have an explicit mention of the n parameter that you have here. It's kind of an attractive thing. The time is defined as relational expressions between the variables of the system, yet you need this lattice framework with the little n that was completely unphysical to make sense of the whole story, but it drops out at the end. So I find that reasonably attractive. So I would argue that if you want to quantize gravity using these ideas, this is probably the way you want to go, and not the naive way of implementing the unitary transformation or implementing the canonical transformation as a unitary operator. I'm running out of time. Let me conclude here, therefore. This is kind of a sound bite of today's talk. I think it kind of convinced you, I hope I convinced you, that it's kind of tricky to formulate consistently discrete theories on the lattice. You just take your theory, put it in the lattice, it's not going to work, at least for gravity. The construction might be useful in numerical relativity. We all know in numerical relativity there are many problems that arise, and therefore it's only by proof and practice that things might work. These discrete or this consistent discretizations we're discussing here guarantee that you are always on the discrete constraint surface as you evolve. So this problem that was raised there, that you can depart exponentially from the constraint surface, here cannot happen. You're guaranteed to be on the discrete constraint surface. But it could be that your discrete constraint surface and your continuous one depart from each other. And therefore, I gain nothing from this. So this is only going to be proved experimentally. We have the tools to formulate discrete field theories canonically, including gravity, as we argued. An interesting fact, if you go back and consider that the quantization is given by the implementation of the finite canonical transformation as a unitary operator, is the fact that what you're computing is essentially what people do when they compute the path integral, right? And the path integral is this unitary operator. So by formulating, I mean, for years there's been kind of tension between the canonical and path integral approach and how do we make contact between one and the other. Here I'm showing how you can do a canonical theory where the thing you're computing is essentially the path integral. So it should be a realm where you can make contact, say, between canonical and spin form formulations more easily. For the gravitational cases, I think I argued now, but with some detail, I'm not saying that things are straightforward to do, as one would, of course, expect. But in principle, calculations appear as completely feasible, albeit computationally intensive. I mean, I presented how you would handle the problem of time, the fact that you don't have constraints, and the fact that in order not to have constraints, you have to pay a computational price by solving for the laps on the shift. There's a bunch of details in this thing in GRQC where you can also look at the Yang-Mills and BF examples that I couldn't mention in the talk. Thank you.
Some of the kinds of issues that you've been discussing have been seen before in four dimensions, namely in...
I am in four dimensions here.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
There what you do is you approximate the geometry by sort of Buckminster-Fuller type simplicial geometry, which is determined by the edges.
Yes.
If you plug that geometry into the action, integral R, you find that there's no remaining gauge invariance, and all the edges are fixed by the equations, with the exception of one case, right, which is the geometry is flat. Because if it's flat, you can move the vertices around in an arbitrary way, and put another set of edges to try and get a flat space.
Yes.
If you curve, then the edges are fixed. But as you make the triangulation finer and finer, you introduce more and more edges. Physically, what happens is you're looking at the solution, little regions of it become closer and closer to flat, more and more edges which are flat. This is reflected in the action, right, by the fact that the action at every step, right, does have an extremum. Right, but the extremum becomes more and more shallow. It's trying to sort of regenerate the diffeomorphisms, which means it's invariant through some translation. But it just, you have to go a longer and longer way.
Yeah.
And eventually the equations become impossible to deal with. At a sufficient level, they become impossible to deal with numerically in any sufficient accuracy.
Right.
You're trying to sort of solve, look for this very shallow minimum. So somehow this doesn't show up here. Right. That's the no free lunch. That is consistent. That story is consistent with the no free lunch conjecture.
Okay, so let me first answer the best I can that, and then make a comment because we were actually inspired to go into this by Reggie Calculus. As you saw, like the way the continuum limit works here is rather mysterious. It works in different ways in different models. And it works in unexpected ways. I mean, if you asked me a year ago when we started doing this how the continuum limit is going to work, I would have said, oh, you just choose the initial data so that you make your steps really small. But you see there are certain models where you don't do that and the steps become small dynamically, or there are models where you really have to do that. So there's not going to be a unique parallel with Reggie Calculus. It could be that for certain situations that problem actually arises here. It might be that in others it doesn't.
Sure, it would be nice to identify the ones where it doesn't work.
I agree.
It's only a conjecture.
Let me go back to Reggie Calculus and tell you how we were inspired for this. People have been struggling for years to come up with a Hamiltonian formulation of Reggie Calculus. Surprise, surprise. Because they're trying to make sense of a Hamiltonian in a context where the Hamiltonian is not too naturally defined in the discrete context. In fact, Freeman and Jack have a paper in which they tried hard to come up with a Hamiltonian formulation. They discovered what? The Lagrange multipliers get determined. And therefore, to make the theory consistent is very complicated. So that I think they were this away from coming up with something like what we have right now in the context of Reggie Calculus. So, yeah.
I had a question, but follow up on Jim's. So, I mean, isn't it true that you always have a continuum limit in the sense that you make your initial step size, your spatial sort of step size, smaller and smaller? That's always a continuum limit. And your time steps will be smaller. It's just that in some special cases, you discover that there's sort of an accidental continuum.
Well, but I'm worried about the accident, if you want, because it could be that I'm, make my step size smaller and everything's working fine, and then suddenly the model decides to take life of its own and make the step size larger later on, right? It would be the reverse of this accident, a negative accident, not a positive one like this. So I think that's why the example is meaningful, that the continuum limit arises here in funny ways. The example is also attractive, right? I mean, one would like somehow that the universe behaves semi-classically now and very kind of weird way near the singularity in order to avoid it. And that example materializes that. So that's why it's sort of nice, but it's not generic. So.
But I still think that that's must somehow, in general relativity, we know that you can start with a lot of data in a model with positive coupled or constant, and they all look the same at late time, right? Because they all evolve to consider.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but except that in the case of the massless scalar field, that doesn't happen here. I mean, I just get a step size forever in spite of the fact that I have a cosmological constant, so.
You get a step size forever, because the model is reproducing a continuum.
Well, but it's reproducing in the continuum at the same level of accuracy all across. It doesn't get better later. So.
Another danger from regression calculus is
I thought you were an advocate of it. Okay.
Is the discrete equations can be sometimes shown to have spurious solution.
Oh, no. I mean, any discrete theory has tons and tons of solutions that have nothing to do with a continuum theory that are just the solutions that jump around all over the place and don't have a continuum limit. The consistent theories, however, guarantee that they have a solution that approximates the continuum one. Whereas if you do things inconsistently, the continuum solution is not there, right? Yeah.
Even though it's the hot dog.